Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
We have to increase education funding, and what Dunleavy did today sets back that cause, sets back education in Alaska.
The governor's budget vetoes are in, and they include cutting half of an education funding increase. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, June 19th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, a subsea fiber optic cable break is affecting emergency services.
We had to set up a temporary dispatch facility to where people can use VHF for police, fire, and ambulance.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you find yourself asking, what's next? The University of Alaska Anchorage can point you in the right direction. With over 100 fully accredited degree programs and certificates to choose from, plus resources to guide you through your academic experience, your future is in your hands. Whether you're starting over or taking your career to the next level, discover what's next at UAA. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
Governor Mike Dunleavy today vetoed more than $200 million from the state budget, including half of the money the legislature wanted to spend as a one-time increase in public school funding. In a press release, the governor did not mention the $87 million cut to education funding, by far the largest of dozens of vetoes. His spokesman said he was unavailable for an interview. State Senator Forrest Dunbar, an Anchorage Democrat, is disturbed by the loss of funds. He points out that school districts have had flat funding for 6 years while absorbing the major cost of inflation.
We have to increase education funding, and what Dunleavy did today sets back that cause, sets back education in Alaska, and likely will lead to substantial cuts to programs and perhaps increased population loss.
School districts from around the state lobbied for more funding, saying that without an increase in the base student allocation, they would have to cut core programs and, in the case of Anchorage, even close schools. Efforts to increase the formula funding were not successful, but the legislature did pass a one-time school funding boost of $175 million. Dunbar also takes issue with the cuts coming on June 19th, which he sees as an affront to those working to recognize Juneteenth as an important American day of remembrance of liberation. Still, Dunbar says the Senate probably has the votes to override the cut to school funding.
However, I am worried that there might not be enough House Republicans willing to override the governor's veto.
Dunleavy's 46 line item vetoes include other cuts to education, such as $20 million for the UAA campus, $10 million for major school maintenance projects, $5 million for Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, and $3.5 million for Head Start. Outside of education, Dunleavy cut $30 million from the Community Assistance Fund, $10 million from state ferries, and several road and harbor projects. A bush pilot known for his starring role in the Discovery Channel's Flying Wild Alaska series has died after his plane crashed shortly after takeoff Friday morning near Shaktulik. The Alaska Department of Public Safety has identified 68-year-old pilot Jim Tweedo of Unalakleet and 45-year-old passenger Shane Reynolds of Orofino, Idaho. Next of kin have been notified. According to a dispatch from Alaska State Troopers, on Friday, just before noon, troopers were notified of an emergency SOS from an in-reach satellite communications device. The SOS reported a plane crash 35 miles northeast of Shaktulik. According to the dispatch, the Cessna 180 aircraft was witnessed taking off but not climbing and subsequently crashing. It was later reported that both occupants of the aircraft were deceased. Troopers responded from Nome and recovered the two bodies from the crash site. The bodies are being transported to the Alaska State Medical Examiner's Office in Anchorage. The National Transportation Safety Board has been notified of the crash. It's been a week since ice severed a fiber optic cable in the Arctic Ocean, cutting communications to at least half a dozen communities in northern Alaska. Many are still without internet or cellular service, and the company that owns the cable says it will be 2 months until the line is repaired. As KOTZ's Desiree Hagen reports, the break is disrupting normal life for many communities above the Arctic Circle.
Losing internet and cellular connection is more than just missing out on your favorite Netflix series or catching up with friends and family. When emergency services are impacted, lack of communication can be a matter of life or death. The broken fiber optic line cut by a significant ice scouring event last week connected most of Northwest Alaska. Quintillion, the Alaska-based company that owns the line, says the break primarily affected the cities Nome, Kotzebue, Point Hope, Wainwright, and Utqiagvik, and the villages of Atkasuk and Nuiqsut. Last Wednesday, the North Slope Borough issued an emergency declaration stating that the fiber break would severely impact the ability to provide essential services such as search and rescue, police, fire, and utilities. South of the borough seat of Utqiagvik, the community of Atkasuk is feeling the break's repercussions. Doug Whiteman is the mayor of Atkasuk, a community of about 300 people, 60 miles southwest of Utqiagvik. He says emergency communications aren't working like they should between communities.
We had the circumstance with 911 calls. The village police officer could call Barrow and they could hear, but their replies didn't come back to one-way conversation.
Whiteman says the borough is advising the community to stay off the limited internet that's available. He says right now, public safety, the health clinic, and fire are all using one shared satellite phone. Further south, Wainwright, a community of nearly 700 people, is encountering similar challenges.
The break in the fiber cable has hindered our 911 services since Sunday morning when the break happened.
Wainwright Mayor Chester Eacock says they also experienced one-way communication with emergency services in Utqiagvik, which forced them to find a workaround.
So we had to set up a temporary dispatch facility to where people can use VHF for police, fire, and ambulance call-outs.
He says it's not just emergency response that's ground to a halt. It's also daily life.
It's affecting businesses, day-to-day operations. The stores turned into a cash-only stores.
Eacock says the ATMs require an internet connection, so now customers are unable to withdraw money for the cash-only businesses. And Eacock says it's also affecting people who receive assistance like EBT because they can't use their cards. Businesses in Kotzebue are also feeling the effects. Louis Pagel is the owner and lead physician at Arctic Chiropractic. He says his office is without internet, which means he is unable to process billing to insurance companies. His patients can't schedule appointments.
Also, my credit card machine won't work either, so I can't collect payments at the office. So from a financial standpoint, it's pretty detrimental.
Pagel's office isn't alone.
The city is without internet. I went over there yesterday morning to pay my business taxes, and they can't process anything.
Tessa Baldwin is the manager for the city of Kotzebue. She says the fiber break is disrupting government operations and that the city is unable to connect to their server, internet, and phone.
We're very lucky that our emergency services are still in operational mode. However, everything else at the city is down.
This week, Baldwin says the city was scrambling to access their employees' payroll. They were able to resolve this issue, and now over 100 people employed by the city will be receiving their checks only a few days later than scheduled.
It's been extremely difficult to manage a city with no internet or phone service.
Baldwin says there have been other issues, including meeting city grant deadlines and communicating with city partners outside of Kotzebue. In Kotzebue, I'm Desiree Hagen.
Still to come in Alaska News Nightly, researchers head to Mount Edgecumbe, a long dormant volcano that's been rumbling recently.
If we could get inside the crater, We'd like to take some measurements there. However, it's unclear if it's snow-free right now.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Pacific University offers degree-seeking students the opportunity to receive donor-funded scholarships, grants, and other financial aid. Apply for admission to be automatically considered for most scholarships. Complete financial aid applications by priority deadlines to receive optimal consideration. Financial aid counselors are available to assist. Learn more at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
A man is jailed on a first-degree murder charge for the killing of another man in the Two Rivers area east of Fairbanks. Alaska state troopers say 34-year-old Fairbanks resident Wesley Scotty Cruikshank was taken into custody Friday morning at mile 23 Chena Hot Springs Road in the vicinity of a residence where 43-year-old Two Rivers resident Ashton Gaspar Scavette was killed by blunt force trauma earlier in the morning. Troopers say multiple adults were at the home, and it's not clear why Cruikshank attacked Gaspar Scavette. They say Cruikshank ran into the woods but later showed up at a nearby property where he was spotted by a citizen and a trooper arrested him. Cruikshank was taken to Fairbanks Correctional Center. Gaspar Scavette's next of kin have been notified, and his body is being sent to the state medical examiner's office for autopsy. Two bills to advance renewable energy in Alaska stalled in the state legislature this year, but an alternative energy advocate thinks they have a good chance of becoming law in 2024. One bill would create a state green bank to help finance projects like rooftop solar. Chris Rose is executive director of Renewable Energy Alaska Project. He explains the need for a green bank by comparing renewables to cars in the Henry Ford days.
You couldn't get a car loan the day cars were invented. Banks had to figure out what the risk profile of this contraption called a car was before they would decide to loan money for it. Well, with green financing, the banks have not had a lot of experience in what the risk profile is for lending somebody some money to make their home more energy efficient or to put solar panels on their house.
Rose says there is general agreement in the legislature on the merits of a green bank, and Governor Mike Dunleavy has sponsored the bill twice.
Yeah, I think the Green Bank bill will pass next session. I don't think there's a lot of concern about it conceptually. I think people understand that what a fund like this at the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation could do is provide affordable loans to Alaskans.
The second bill would create a renewable portfolio standard. It would mandate that utilities get a certain percentage of their power from renewable sources like wind and solar. Rose sees this as the best way to fill the waning supply of natural gas in South Central Alaska and prevent skyrocketing utility bills.
The utility managers are all talking about importing liquefied natural gas to fill the gap that we're going to see just in about 3 or 4 years in Cook Inlet natural gas. Importing LNG is going to be 40, 50, 60% more expensive than the price of gas now.
Wind and solar, on the other hand, are now the cheapest sources of power and can be built relatively quickly, Rose says. He's optimistic that the renewable portfolio bill will also make it to the governor's desk next year. Rose hopes the committee chairs continue hearings on the bills this summer, but has not heard any updates on that yet. Kinross, Alaska will begin running trucks with trailers this summer between Tetlin and Fairbanks in preparation for a full-scale ore hauling operation scheduled to start next summer. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, a group that opposes the trucking plan says Kinross should wait until the state builds passing lanes and makes other safety improvements.
Kinross will begin trial runs this summer with standard size semi-truck trailer combinations on the 240-mile route from its mine in Tetlin to its mill in Fox. Company officials say the trailers will initially be empty for testing, but later will be loaded, and next year they'll be replaced by the big 95-foot-long, 80-ton double trailer rigs running an average of 60 ore loads a day. Meanwhile, work on a series of passing lanes on the Richardson Highway part of the route, intended to help drivers safely get around the big trucks, isn't expected to begin until August.
We don't have a contractor on board yet.
Carl Heim is DOT's Northern Region Design Engineering Manager.
We're going to advertise that project here, I'm going to say, in 2 weeks. So we'll have a low bid contractor middle of July.
Heim says if all goes well, the contractor may be able to begin surveying and clearing on one or two of the passing lanes in August. But he says it's unlikely that any construction on the passing lanes will be done till next summer.
I don't expect a lot of dirt moving activity this year just due to the fact that this project came out a little bit later than we would normally anticipate due to design constraints.
Members of a group opposed to the trucking plan say the passing lanes and other safety improvements should be completed before the big trucks roll.
I mean, it just is common sense to wait until bridges are replaced and passing lanes are done and some other improvements.
Barbara Schumann is a spokesperson for Advocates for Safe Alaska Highways. She says members of the group think the ore hauling route needs more than just additional passing lanes. It also needs work like replacing deteriorated asphalt and bridges built in the 1940s and 50s.
Why not wait until all that construction is done so that you're sure that the bridges aren't going to crumble underneath this weight of the big trucks?
The DOT's original plan included drainage improvements, embankment repairs, utility relocations, and guardrail work. But Heim says the project's been delayed and trimmed back, including elimination of two Richardson Highway passing lanes along a section of the Tanana River north of Quartz Lake.
The cost of those started to balloon to $5 to $8 million per location, and I only had $40 million or $50 million to spend on this project, so I had to get rid of a couple of those spots that were on the Tanana Riverside.
Heim says construction of the passing lanes on the Richardson between Delta Junction and Fairbanks will begin in earnest in 2024. He says the contractor will decide the order in which they're built. Kinross trucking contractor Black Gold Express will begin full-blown ore hauling operation sometime after July 1st of next year. A company spokesperson says that time frame depends on the lower 48 manufacturer of the trucks getting the big rigs built and delivered to Alaska, as well as training the drivers and building a way station at the Manh Choh mine in Tetlin. The spokesperson said the company also wants to wait until enough gold ore is stockpiled at the mine to keep the trucks loaded and rolling. The DOT's Heim says the passing lanes should be completed by the fall of 2025. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Air Cargo, serving the commerce and business needs of 20 Alaska communities, from Adak to Barrow to Ketchikan. More information at alaskacargo.com. If you find yourself asking, what's next? The University of Alaska Anchorage can point you in the right direction. With over 100 fully accredited degree programs and certificates to choose from, plus resources to guide you through your academic experience, your future is in your hands. Whether you're starting over or taking your career to the next level, discover what's next at UAA. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
Alaska does not have many ticks for now, but Dr. Micah Hahn, associate professor at the University of Alaska Anchorage, says that could change. As winters become milder, the tiny blood-sucking parasites are able to survive farther and farther north. Hahn says the western deer tick, known for carrying Lyme disease, has found its way up into British Columbia.
We're seeing that the edge of their population is creeping northward, and that's definitely related to climate change and being able to support populations at higher latitudes.
Alaska does have some native ticks, but human encounters are not very common. Many prefer feeding on wildlife like voles and squirrels. Hahn says it's important for Alaskans to be informed.
There's lots of room for education. I think a lot of Alaskans don't know that we actually have any ticks in the state.
The Alaska Department of Health released a report by Hahn on Wednesday detailing the presence of ticks in the state. Hahn says the report is an account of years of research that started back in 2010. In addition to climate modeling, researchers collected over 2,000 ticks, mainly through Hahn's Submit a Tick program. The program, started in 2018, lets anyone who finds a tick mail it in a crush-proof container to the state veterinarian's office for identification and pathogen testing. Out of all the ticks they collected, only one carried the bacteria that causes Lyme disease, and it had hitched a ride to Alaska on a dog who traveled from New York. Han says none of the native tick species they collected carry diseases that could spread to humans. But because they're not currently a threat in Alaska, Han says Alaskans might not take proper precautions when traveling to places where ticks are more dangerous. They could bring non-native ticks back with them.
You know, when you're traveling to a part of the United States where there are a lot of ticks, New England, the Southeast, you know, California, you need to be aware of what ticks look like, you know, wear DEET, long pants, socks when you're hiking, and then know how to do a tick check.
Han says when you're taking a shower and looking for ticks, they have flat brown bodies that can be as small as a pinhead. Han also suggests that pet owners ask their vets about tick medication prior to traveling. More information on preventing tick bites can be found on the CDC website. A University of Alaska Fairbanks lead research team has found the earliest known evidence of freshwater fishing in the Americas. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
UAF anthropology professor Ben Potter says bones of species including whitefish, burbot, and pike were discovered at long-studied ancient encampments along the Tanana River between Fairbanks and Delta Junction.
All of the major fish species used by Dene peoples in the region now traditionally are also found in the very earliest record up to 13,000 years ago.
Potter says the freshwater fishbone finds follow the earlier discovery of latter-era salmon bones, expanding understanding of fishing at the end of the last ice age.
It seems like it's a response to climate change at the end of the last ice age, where people expanded their diet to include more fishing, particularly freshwater fishing early on. And then after the onset of the Holocene, the spread of the boreal forest, we don't see evidence of fishing until much later in time. So it seems like it's a response to climate conditions.
Potter says fishing during this dry, cold period of time indicates a decreased availability of the primary food source, large mammals.
If there's fewer bison or elk on the landscape, then you turn to other resources. And I would say, you know, these very early Alaskans are extremely adaptable. I mean, it's, you know, the suite of technological adaptations that they developed, very sophisticated stone technology, and probably resource management strategies too. And so we're just beginning to get glimpses of this complexity in some of the work that we're doing.
Potter says no evidence of fish hooks or spears has been found, suggesting the fish were harvested with nets or weirs that did not survive. He emphasizes that the latest findings are the products of a team of researchers working at one of the densest concentrations of ice age sites in the Americas. Potter is co-lead author of the study, which was recently published in the journal Science Advances. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Sitka's Mount Edgecumbe volcano is coming under closer scrutiny this summer as research teams follow up on the earthquake swarm that occurred under the mountain in the spring of last year and satellite data that show the flanks of the peak steadily inflating since about 2018. While no eruption is imminent, scientists from the University of Alaska Fairbanks Geophysical Institute recently spent a few days on the flanks of the crater and on surrounding beaches collecting information that they hope sheds light on what's brewing beneath the surface. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Don't you let go!
You've probably seen it a few times. Gollum and the One Ring have plunged into the lava river at the bottom of Mount Doom, and Samwise is trying to pull Frodo back before he suffers the same fate.
Wait!
Luckily, hobbits have a body chemistry more favorable to heroics inside a volcano. If it had been Aragorn or any of the other human characters in Lord of the Rings helping to destroy the ring, they might have been long gone, passed out in the high concentration of carbon dioxide gas produced in this environment. CO2 can't be smelled or seen, but a team of scientists from the Alaska Geophysical Institute knows how to detect it. Six of them spent a few days helicoptering between Sitka and Mount Edgecumbe in early June, testing the soil of Kruzoff Island for CO2. I caught up with them at the Sitka airport waiting for a break in the weather.
So today, hopefully, the weather is looking good, so we're hoping to make it to the summit of Edgecumbe today. And we're hoping to measure diffuse CO2, those same CO2 measurements we've been taking along the flanks of the volcano. And then if we could get inside the crater We'd like to take some measurements there. However, it's unclear if it's snow-free right now.
Claire Puglio is a doctoral student at the University of Alaska Fairbanks under research assistant professor Tarsilo Girona. Girona has a theory that low-temperature thermal anomalies detected by satellite data suggest increased activity in magma that may be a precursor to an eruption. The same CO2 that would make a volcano inhospitable to Aragorn could possibly be warming the flanks of Mount Edgecombe.
One of the hypotheses we have to understand those signals is that the gas that is moving from the magma source to the surface is producing this warming in the surface.
Girona and Puglio are two of the six members of the team from the Alaska Geophysical Institute studying gas emissions on Mount Edgecombe. The project is funded by NASA as part of a program for early career scientists. They're tackling the problem on two fronts, in the air and on the land, or better said, in the land. Carlo Cardellini is from the University of Perugia in Italy. He's helped develop the method for collecting gas from the soil using a device called an accumulation chamber. But he's got a slightly more flavorful metaphor.
And we place a chamber on the top of the soil. It's like a cooking pot. And we leave the concentration of carbon dioxide increase inside the chamber. And the rate of increasing is something that is linked to the amount of gas that is passing from the soil to the atmosphere. So we are catching this increase and we can compute how much gas is escaping from the soil.
Cardellini uses an infrared sensor that continuously measures the concentration of CO2 in the cooking pot, if you will. But he also collects samples to take back and study in the lab. CO2 produced by magma will have a different isotopic signature than CO2 produced by organic decomposition. And there is a lot of organic decomposition on the slopes of Mount Edgecombe, which are primarily wetlands. For the bigger picture, you've got to be airborne. Taryn Lopez is a volcanologist with the Alaska Volcano Observatory. While the others are sampling the slopes of the crater, she'll be overhead doing what is called a gas flight.
Some gases exsolve, which means they form bubbles really deep, such as CO2, where things like water and SO2, which are common volcanic gases, exsolve very shallow. What we're looking for is the composition of the gases. If we see gases and if we see the composition, we can tell if the magma is deep or shallow.
This is the first morning of several that the team has been in Sitka, that the rim of the Mount Edgecombe crater is visible 3,200 feet above Sitka Sound, and the helicopter pilot is ready to fly. Tarsilo Girona tells me that all the data and information collected by the Geophysical Institute team will be published in several papers and shared with the Alaska Volcano Observatory, which is sending its own team to Mount Edgecombe later this summer. And hopefully, Girona said, we can better understand how the volcano works. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin, Michael Finelli, and Dev Hardiker in Anchorage, Desiree Hagen in Kotzebue, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde. I'm Casey Grove. Happy Juneteenth and good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Air Cargo, providing Gold Streak Express shipping for urgent deliveries throughout Alaska, with connections to more than 100 destinations in the lower 48 and Hawaii. More at alaskacargo.com.
And by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.